if I was in a rush, especially if I was doing stuff in pencil, I'd come to ink it and think, I haven't drawn anything here that I can work with. You know, it looks great. But as soon as I scan it in, I realise I've got no background and none of the perspective's right. And there's like three wiggly lines, which looks like a beautiful something when you look at the paper. But when I come to, how do I make this into a final piece of art? Working digitally kind of forced me to do enough work to start with that I wouldn't end up with that problem.
Hey, yeah. Thanks for listening. This last week, there's been a lot of unpleasant chatter about people in the comic book industry and their behavior. I know that the world wants no bad people or people didn't do stupid things or selfish things, but it's just not how things are. We are messy, messy beings. I wish we were as empathetic and understanding and willing to be so as we are to condemn others for their behaviors. I often say we don't know the truth. We don't know the reality. We know what we hear, and that doesn't mean we know anything. It just means we heard something. That doesn't always mean that it is correct. It is how you feel, but what we do with our feelings has impact in the world. And we need to be conscious of these things. Whether you like something or don't like something, or like someone or don't like someone, I think we often get confused by the popularity game of life and the amplifier turned up to 10 that social media can be doesn't really help the situation. I struggle with that one all the time here because I'm not infallible. I'm like everyone else. I want to be acknowledged for the things that I do. And I hope that the things that I do make people happy. And wouldn't that be great if everyone responded in kind? Some people get that, and that's great. But the problem that can result of that is if that sense of good job becomes all there is in your life. If there's a threat of that going away, or if one's identity is not independent of that, that can be a tragic event for a person. I think I'm just saying this as much for myself as I am for anybody out there. It doesn't matter what happens and what other people say in life. We all go through terrible things. We all have great losses in life, whether they are personal or professional, but we can always find a way through. So be kind to yourself. Be kind to other people. None of this is a big deal. When all this kind of stuff happens, all I think I want to do is to not really participate so much. Use the tools that I have and plop out an episode and not pay attention to what's happening out there. And maybe that's like the old classic, don't read your reviews. I don't know. But I don't know. I hope every time something terrible happens, I hope something good can come from it. Maybe that'll be the case. Maybe. Today's episode, Pie Par. what an intro. Pie is someone who I've just discovered as an artist within the last year. Pi is unbelievable. His art, it is so cool. If you are unfamiliar with Petrolhead, it's out at Image. I think all 5 issues have hit the stands. Man, it is cool. You don't have to like cars to like this. It's beyond cars, but the cars are really cool. I'm super happy to share this one with you, and I hope you enjoy this talk with Pi Par.
That's personally what I find most sort of quite just grounding. People you really look up to and telling you about struggles and insecurities they have just the same as everyone else, really.
Yeah, right, right.
Most useful. These people aren't superheroes. They're just good at doing a job.
No, they're very good at this one sort of lonely task of staring at a drawing and, you know, making it come together, or sitting at a blank page and writing a story. I mean, these are they're grueling, you know, semi-thankless tasks. You know, like, I don't know about you, but like, I remember when I handed my first assignment in, I was like, I was, you know, waiting for the trumpets to sound and all this kind of stuff, because I figured like I did it, like I pulled it in, and the response was, great, thanks.
Next.
I'm like, oh, okay, this isn't going to go up on the refrigerator, so I guess guess I got to go get another gig. So you mentioned something about a cloud drive backup for the work. And what is your like digital like chain process? Like, how do you ensure that you're not going to like lose something?
I basically just make copies of everything I do all the time in multiple different places. It's the amount, you know, it's not like I've lost things a lot, but especially if you're working long hours, you have a tendency to save over the wrong thing, flatten something you shouldn't. And I just think the more backups you have, the better. So, but because I had got pretty quick internet, so I was just working directly off Google Drive. And then anything I'd changed at the end of the day, I just dragged onto my desktop. And then I have a Dropbox as well. So, you know, once I've finished the whole thing, then I'll put it on there. Otherwise, your version control gets a bit crazy, and all of a sudden you're super paranoid about, you know, you've made like 3 minuscule changes to one Photoshop file, and you're not sure that you've got it in all the different places and blah.
Yeah, totally. Do you? I keep thinking about like a network, like creating a local network to have like a external drive that's local, you know, my laptop, and then have, you know, my digital, you know, cloud files, just because I'm like, well, do I want to, like, I'm afraid of losing like a thing. Does that like, do you think about having that, like that local network drive too?
Oh, see what you mean? Like an external drive that I can kind of just stick things on.
Yeah. Like you can take, cause you can like take an old, like, you know, one of the Tower G4s, and you can just load it up with hard drives right there on your Ethernet.
That's actually not a bad idea. I've got an old G4 in the loft. I could just buy a load of that. I mean, it's a bit old now. In fact, I'm looking to upgrade my Mac at the minute, and I was wondering whether I could I've since found out you can't, which I'm a bit gutted about. Use this iMac that I'm on now as a monitor, and then buy like a more sort of updated Mac Mini.
Right.
But apparently they've taken that functionality out. So they used to be able to do, which of course they have, you know, something useful.
Of course.
but then, yeah, I could use sort of the hard drive on it as a sort of backup drive, the monitor as a screen for the Mac Mini, and then the Mac Mini to actually do the work.
Totally. Like,
I think that's going to work. That sounds great on paper, but apparently it doesn't work.
No, but they're like, they're already playing chess. They're already a couple moves ahead. They're like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, aha, I got you now. And then they're like, no, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Because I am going to have to buy a monitor if I do that. And Apple monitors are brilliant, really.
They're expensive.
But yeah, I'm not buying one of their monitors. It's not happening. I mean, I've barely got enough money to buy the computer. So I'm not shelling out.
No, I know. I know. It's just, it's so, like, my model's always been, buy the most expensive Mac I need for the job so it can last the longest. That was always my
yes,
approach. Same. But I feel that they're changing things so much quicker now than they used to, that I think that model may not work anymore. I may have to be like one of these like hustlers and try to figure out how to do it every year or two to try to stay on top of something.
Yeah, before your own one, before the one sort of degrades so much that it's not really worth it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, totally.
This is like a, what's this now? So we're getting into sort of Mac crap now. Yeah, this is a 2013. So, okay,
yeah.
Like, but what I love about that is I literally bought the most expensive one I could, got as much RAM as I could. I've never had a problem with it in the 10 years that I've been. It's brilliant. It's just now that I can't use the latest version of Photoshop. I can't get the latest version of InDesign. I can't update Google Chrome, as we've already discussed. So, you know, I'm being forced to. I'd work on this forever.
Yeah.
Although, you know, I think being forced to change is probably a good thing. It's one of the things I worry about being a freelancer is sort of atrophying of your skills in certain areas. Certainly as far as technology goes. I did some work in a design studio for a little while and they're all using Figma and I was like, oh God, I don't even know how to. I sort of had a word with one of the more senior designers, one of the older guys. I was like, do you still use InDesign? Is that all right? And he's like, oh yeah, I don't use Figma. I hate it. It's only for the kids, you know.
I did a job last year for eBay and everybody, you know, they were many decades younger than I on the sort of the client side team, and everything was all Figma. And I'm like, oh, I have no idea like what this is all about. And I just like was like, oh, great, that looks fantastic. And pitch over my ideas, and they would like take everything and throw it into Figma. And I'm like, okay, this is the future.
Yeah, I don't know whether I want to learn it or not. I mean, I don't do enough design work to really warrant the time it would take to get any good, I suppose. But
Well, it's that you touched on the idea like not letting your skills atrophy, but like when you're freelancing, you have to pick up so many disparate skills to pay the bills that there's a lot of upkeep. And then if you kind of get a groove, you kind of wear these grooves deep into like this one program or whatever or whatever your process is. And then like every so often, like a new project will come in and you're like, I need to learn a whole new thing just to be able to get through this, which isn't as easy as it was a while ago.
No, that's right. But you're right about the groove thing though. You just learn a specific way to do stuff because that's the way you've learned to get the quality that you require.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I realized in the other day, like in Illustrator, I used to think I was pretty good in Illustrator, and then I think I had a load of reels pop up on Instagram of all these kids doing stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, how the hell do you do this? So I've like started. I started saving them all to watch, like an old person.
Oh my God! Like the amount of sort of like saved things to watch to improve one's kung fu skill and whatever it is, I have they're all over the place, and I never have the time to like sit down and like just do that to like say, oh, I could probably pick up a couple things. Like, nah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I keep thinking, I'll watch that because that'll be useful for some job I'm doing, or I'll find a way to, I can apply that sort of technique for something because they're sort of weirdly specific in the instructions. But you think, well, that would be useful in a certain scenario. But as you say, I've still not done it. I mean, I've been using Illustrator this afternoon and I'm like, yeah, could I learn something now, or should I just do it the old way because I need to get it finished, you know?
And I know that the things I do in Photoshop or Illustrator, I am probably running six or more steps longer than what I need to. Like there's probably a way to do it in a fraction of the steps. And I just don't, I know how I learned how to do it in 1998. And I'm still going that direction. And like some like, you know, 18-year-old goes, just push this button here. And it does it for you. And you go, oh, thanks. And then I'll forget what button that is. So I'm still doing my old way.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But I mean, listen, yeah, wow, I'm old. But it is like that. Like, I mean, there was this whole decade of my life, there was no question about that. It was all a matter of what you could do with a pencil in your hand on a piece of paper. That's all. There was nothing else. That's all there was. You know, someone else handled the coloring and like two people did it digitally. The rest of it was all done on paper. So. Oh, did I freeze? All right, there. We unfroze. But you do this insanely cool digital work. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. And I look at it. I mean, I don't know. Are you like, I mean, do you like forensically break down artwork when you're looking at it? Like you look at something and go, how did they get to this point?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the stuff you end up really liking is the thing you don't know how they've done it.
Yes, totally. Totally. There's like, there's a very small number of artists out there in my life that I look at and I could not recreate what they do. Not saying I could draw or paint like they could do, but I could understand the techniques that they're using to employ that. Like, I'm going to butcher his name, Esad Ribak. Ribak. He's okay. Like, yeah, like he did that really killer Thor Godkiller run with Jason Aaron years ago. Mm-hmm. And this guy's, his art, it's just like, I'm like, how did he do this? Like, I don't know how he got to that final point. And so I look at your work and at, like, it's so funny because it's really deceptive. I look at it and I go, oh, it's this. And then I look at him like, oh no, he's like using solid colors. He's not like every, it's like you're painting in gouache, but in a digital form.
Yeah. Like I try and avoid using too many gradients. I use gradients in the sort of, in like a kind of base layer and then make sure my highlights are all single solid colors. Mm-hmm. Just because I like that kind of graphic feel to it, really.
Yeah.
It started off as a sort of trying to limit my palette a little bit. Because one of the problems with doing digital stuff is you can use any color you like and then it just ends up a bit of a mess. So mm-hmm. If you limit your palette, if you have some kind of restriction on the way you work always comes out stronger, I think.
Isn't that the structure about creativity, is that every limitation creates better sort of solutions?
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. There's the rule of threes. You know, you have the base and then you have a low and you have a high. Like that's the kind of the basic, how do you get a render? Like this is how you can tell a differentiate between a push and a pull with color and light. And I think it seems to me you're at a five, you do five. Like I noticed that there's like kind of five levels going from the darkest to the brightest on average. Okay. So that's something you actually kind of have in your head of like how.
Yes, a little bit. Yeah. A comic I did years ago, I deliberately made myself color the whole thing. It was all black and white. And I ended up using a sort of like a color layer over the top to give it some tone. But when I was coloring it, I kept to like black 75%, 50% gray, 25% and white. And that I just tried to do the most I could without resorting to graduations or stuff like that. Yeah, so I sort of deliberately stuck to that. So it was like started at gray on every page, did the black line work, and then one highlight and one low light and white. And then blood was the other color. So it was all like grayscale and blood. And it looked so cool. And I kind of carried that across to this in that, like, I don't want to, just do two and keep it. So I was thinking as well, almost like a labor saving or a time saving thing. I want to use less colors. But then I ended up spending just as long working out those three colors than I did if I'd just done everything, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, because it's tough if you think about it in the terms that, because you're handling the visuals, you know, all of them, rather than, you know, handing inking or coloring off to somebody else. So you have to really structure your process to be able to be however efficient you could possibly be.
Mm.
Otherwise, I mean, all I felt first looking at your stuff was like this terrible sense of floundering. I'm like, oh my God, I would just be all over the place trying to figure out. But like, I didn't come to it, you know, in an organic fashion, how you did. So I was trying to like, it would be like, if I got a phone call, like, hey, pie's down, you got to take it over. And I'm like, oh, you know? That was my first reaction. And I guess that's a good reaction because I like the work and I wanted to, like, I'm like, I would, you know, it's like getting that dream. Like, hey, your favorite guitarist is sick tonight. You're taking over. And the show's at Wembley. Have fun. And so, but like, how structured is your, like your actual page file? Like when you're like approaching it, what is your, like
really like, do it the same way every time. Like my Photoshop, I use Clip Studio now, but, they're all neatly folded. Most of the files, all the layers are the same within each thing. Like, you know, I have a set process. So it's always like a sort of an ink layer, a kind of layer that I draw over the top when I'm finished, a mid-tones, a highlight, a shadow layer. The background's normally separate. And then most of my individual panels are folders as well. So I won't color a page as one.
Wow.
I just find that helps because I know where I am with stuff. I mean, you do have to get, you have to sort of come to that though, because like, for example, the first page in Petrolhead I did, which is a long time before any of the others, was the very first page of the first story. Okay. And that was when, before I didn't have a palette and I didn't have, me and Rob came to draw it or came to work on it. We suddenly realized I didn't actually know what color Petrolhead was, because with our sample thing that we sent to Image was really false colored. I'd just done everything in this sort of orange cast. And I suddenly thought, what color is he? I don't know. What color is his head? What color is his car? I haven't got a clue. So I spent a bit of time working that out. And that first page was a bit of a learning experience. So that really strong orange light ended up informing almost the rest of the book. Because it worked really well. And I'm right, okay, I'll stick with that. And then I'll try and keep it as neutral or as sort of, you know, if I want to draw a face blue, I'm just going to do it blue. But as the book progressed, as I got used to that technique, it kind of went back to more normal colors. It was less false colored. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Yeah, no, totally. Totally. But I like how you like that, that false color became the mother color and then the informative color, this is the tone, this is the backdrop, this is our color grading is going to have this orange hue, and then we're going to pull the world out from this sort of, you know, miasma.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like Petrolhead being with an orange head and this very neutral green body. I mean, he's the same color as the buildings and the light that is cast onto them. Which that's interesting then, because later on when I change the color palette, he really stands out. You know, when he's in the smog zone, everything gets sort of brown and yellow.
Yeah,
he's much brighter.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, that's the curse of like putting the package together and sending it out there, because you don't know, you have no idea if it's going to get picked up, and then it's like, okay, this is a go, and it's like, okay, now we actually have to do the work.
Like, that's right. Hold on, I haven't even thought about this. Do I like it?
Like, oh, we have a whole completely new book. I'm sorry. It's really interesting, because like the other sensation I get when I look at it is, you know, like colored acrylic, like that sort of, you have a very sort of glossy colored layer, like layers of cut acrylic kind of placard on top of each other. That's sort of like one of the sort of the stylish way that you choose your hues and how they fit together. It has a really kind of, I don't know, is that intentional?
So is it intentional, do you say?
Yeah. I mean, do you want it to look kind of like in that sort of?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, because I've got quite a precise way of working, I do have trouble sometimes with slightly more organic, because one of the downsides of using computers, for example, is you can't quite get the same level of textures you can if you're using a pen and ink, or you know, you can't smudge stuff around in the same way without being really artificial about it. But I think, well, why am you using the computer if I might as well just go and do it properly? If I'm going to spend all that time making it look hand drawn, I might as well go and hand draw it. So is it deliberately kind of leaned into the tools that the computer can give you to create work?
Yeah. So you said Clip Studio. I mean, when I draw on a computer, I love to draw on Clip Studio. I think it is the best of the drawing tool programs out there. But I've found that the coloring I have a very hard time with in Clip Studio compared to Photoshop.
Right. How come? What do you find different?
I don't know whether it's going back to the trenches, you know, the ruts in the road, and that I'm much more comfortable with the interface, and I can kind of move quicker in that respect, but I don't feel I have the same level of flexibility when doing the coloring on Clip.
I mean, there are undoubtedly some things I still use both, like, so I'll swap between the two to do specific jobs. There's a few not layer effects, but there's a few useful tools in Photoshop that you just can't quite replicate. So I will end up and also you can't paste Illustrator graphics straight into Clip Studio. So I end up sort of saving stuff, opening it, pasting it across.
Okay.
There's other things I like in Photoshop that Clip Studio doesn't have. If you're using the transform tool, for example, you can swap between the different types of things. So you can go from a mesh transformation to a a wall to a, whereas, which is really useful for keeping your bounding box in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I do miss those kind of things, but you're absolutely right. Like the basic pen tool in Clip Studio is so much better than the Photoshop one.
I mean, you know, even going, you know, more basic drawing panels, it's almost a no brainer in that respect. Like if I was like, hey, you had to do this, you have to do it on a computer and here are your options of tools. Once I hit that tool, I'm like, oh, well, there's no reason to spend the extra time in any of the other programs trying to just get your panels.
I'll be honest. I've never tried the actual panel tool in Clip Studio. I normally paste them from InDesign.
Oh.
like a weirdo.
so you're starting your, so walk me through your process then. Like, so Rob sends you the script. And then after you redline it and send it back to him for changes, that's a joke.
After a time to rewrite all this awful dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't draw with this terrible dialogue. and then but what do you do when you get the script?
I'll normally do a load of quick thumbnails. So that'll be normally on the iPad or something. Okay. I can do them on screen as well, but I'll just do really quick, you know, working out where the panels fit together, what angles to use, that sort of stuff. He'll take a look at it. I'll then, because obviously I'm doing all the collating and I've got a design background anyway, I tend to have a master file in InDesign where I've got the Photoshop file for the art, the Illustrator file for the lettering, and then I'll have another layer with I'll put the rough in, that I've just, put the thumbnail in that I've just done, and then work out the panel borders in InDesign, and then copy and paste them into a high-res file and start from there. I'll use Clip Studio and Photoshop to do all the art, and then letter it in Illustrator, put it all together in InDesign again, and make a PDF.
You're all over the place.
That's right. Well, I think, like I said, my first break in comics was working at 2000 E about 20 years ago. And I was the backroom guy putting together other people's art, making lettering edits, not doing any of the stuff that anyone cares about. So I've kind of given myself that job. Now I'm a freelancer as well. I've just kind of carried on doing it that way, but then doing everyone else's as well.
Yeah, no, I mean... I get it. I did a comic book with some friends, and I get it. I was just with another comic book friend over the weekend, and they completed their Kickstarter, and they're ready to go to the printers pretty soon. He's like, "Would you mind if I just send you the files so you can make sure that it's correct?" Because he doesn't. But for me, being a designer for 25 years, you know, it's like all that stuff is kind of like muscle memory compared to all the other junk that has to happen. But if you don't do it, if you never send files out for press, I mean, really sending it out for press, it's a big question mark.
No, that's right. It's always surprising to me, how many artists, especially when they're starting out, don't know how their work fits into this process further down the line.
Yeah.
You see a lot of people who will send stuff, it's like just basic things like not understanding bleed, but other stuff is helpful or not really, sending your art in at the same size and just little things to make the process. You get obsessed about it when you're doing it week in, week out, and you've got some guy who's like, oh God, how the hell does this fit on the page? Got a panel up here in the corner that's going off the edge or whatever. always maybe too careful with that kind of stuff in my own work, and it ends up looking very cookie cutter.
Well, that's the thing. I think design, the world of graphic design encourages process, process in creativity. Like if you are a designer who is a brand designer or a product designer, pick a category, there's a very strong emphasis on process, what's your process and how do you get the creative things going, and there's all these tricks and tools that you employ, because you kind of, because listen, you're a professional, you're out there doing it over and over again. You have to kind of get these things going to do it every single day. And it's, you just, but like creativity is kind of a different thing, you know? And so I think a lot of people who draw comic books don't think of it in a process term, especially early on. You're just kind of like excited and filled with a ton of energy, and you know, you overcome any shortcomings with a lot more, you know, late hours.
Yeah, that's certainly true. I still find graphic design work, I find it easy to fall into that hole that you where the work just comes out, and I don't know how long. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether it's ever going to flip over. I still find it a struggle to, when I'm starting on a project, I find it really difficult. Whereas if I've got a design job in, I'll just open it up and get going. Like as you say, you're kind of driven by your process a bit more. Mm-hmm. So you have certain things you've got to do, which almost get you in that zone, you know, just literally opening up a document, making it the right size. It gets you working without having to do anything difficult.
Totally. Yeah, no, I think about that. I think about, you know, I mean, even sitting down and going, okay, let me just start thinking some type selects. And so you start going through your fonts to kind of figure out what might be appropriate. And even in that process, then you start iterating, you know, like, I wonder like how these two look together. And then you start doing that. And that's just kind of very soft way of getting whatever that, you know, whatever the need of the project would be. Do you, with the clip file, going back to this, like I would, like my mind is going, oh, I would have like a master clip studio file that has all those sort of, you know, layers in a folder, you know, all in folders, and it's just a blank one that you would then drop in. Like clearly you're dropping your InDesign thing into that, and then you're like, do you have it like that?
Yeah, I'll have like a master file, but it won't have much in it. It'll literally have like a gray background.
Yep.
And then like some sort of like a layer to show me where the trim is, so that I can see what it looks. If I'm doing a full bleed image, it doesn't end up too close to the edge or whatever. And then literally just paste it in. Add, I don't know, one folder for each panel. Mm-hmm. And then save that out. And I'll normally do that, as you say, to start with. You know, I'll make all 20. If I'm doing like a single part of the comic, I'll make all 20 of those to start with, and then I'll paste that rough thumbnail into it, break it up into those panels, so I can, you know, properly get the composition right.
Yeah, yeah.
I tend to letter it, like after the sort of, I say pencils, but I'm doing it digitally on this one. I'll tend to letter the pencils as well, just to make sure it fits, and you can make any adjustments and stuff before I ink it.
Okay.
But that's one of the benefits of doing all this stuff yourself, is that I've got a guess about how much space certain things are going to take up. And if they're not working, I can change it before I've gone too far.
You don't, you just don't demand Rob write shorter sentences?
Well, sometimes he'll say, oh, that's a bit cramped, I'll remove it.
Yeah. And folks, don't change the size of your typeface just to make something.
Yeah, that's right. Just make it 4 points throughout. It's fine.
Yeah, it'd be fine. No one will notice. So what was the origin of the story for you on your end? Like, were you and Rob chatting about this, or is this something he came to you?
During lockdown, I'd got pretty fed up with the work that I was getting in. You know, I was doing a bit of comic stuff here and there, but I do lots of other things as well. And especially because of lockdown, we had the kids at home. My wife wasn't furloughed, so we were both having to, and obviously being freelance, I don't get paid if I don't work. Mm-hmm. So we're having to do homeschool and only working half a day each day. It was just murder. So I just ended up like prioritizing jobs that just paid money that I wasn't remotely interested in. And after about a year of it, I was like, man, I can't. Like, why am I even freelance? I might as well go and get a job doing anything, because this isn't stuff, I'm not actively chasing anything. I'm just doing whatever I can. So anyway, I had enough of a sort of cushion of money that I thought, oh, I'm just going to spend 2 weeks doing something that I want to do for a project that I had. I think I was like inspired by Deathburger. Do you know what's his name? Osan Gonzalez.
Yeah.
Osan. Yes. He did this really cool art book, which was kind of a comic, but just an excuse to put all of his shit in one big volume, you know, just stuff that he liked to draw, I think. So it's like, mm-hmm. there was a bit of a narrative, so there might be some comic-ish pages, but it was more or less like lots and lots of full-page illustrations. It's called The Future Is Now, and it's really good. And I just really like that idea. It's a project that he's clearly just doing for himself. So I thought, right, I'm going to take a couple of weeks, just start working on all this stuff I've had in the back of my head for ages. So it was a lot of things I like to draw. So I think people do respond to, if you like something, people respond to that. So I did a load of cars and a load of robots, and I did a load of graphic design for like fictional stupid race series. And just in jokes and nice colours. Anyway, so I put a load of those online, and then Rob got in touch and said, oh, I really like these. They kind of look like a world that exists already. Do you want to turn it into a comic? And I said, yeah, okay. Because, I had a vague idea of doing that myself, but everything that I'm no writer. I mean, I can do lots of things, but I'm no writer. I can't take that idea and twist it to be interesting. That's just a skill that I lack. And what he came back with was just better than anything I had in mind, which was lovely. So we went from there, really.
Yeah, that's cool. It's tail wagging the dog in that respect, because, you know, usually it's the other way around. The writer is like, hey, I've got this idea. And they go running around trying to find the person to execute this idea. And you just were expressing, you know, this visual interest and building, you know, world building through imagery that inspired him to say, I think I could make an idea, like a story from this.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. And like I said, what he turned it into is not what I had in mind, but it's so much better than the sum of the two things.
Yeah.
It's just been a joy, really. And like, and also it kind of just shows that you trust yourself to do one of the first times I've ever specifically chased work or deliberately spent some time doing something that I wanted to do instead of the normal freelance life of doing something that someone else wants you to do. And it paid off in the best way.
I can't tell you how much I identify with that. How hard that sort of just hits me hearing that. Because I lived, you know, 25 years of being a freelancer in that mindset, just doing work or being an employee somewhere and doing the job and not making the thing that I wanted to make. And anytime I would do the thing that I wanted to do, which was never a money-making venture, it was just an interest, it was super fulfilling, but also really well received. It never, like, people will go, wow, that's so cool. And, but I didn't have the sort of like, oh, yeah, but, you know, I didn't chase after it. And then it took a while for me to go, I think I'm just going to do my own thing. And that level of satisfaction. And I don't know why, I can't really track it back to an early point when I just said, no, that I'm not going to chase that. I mean, it is easy to not think about it when you get to draw Spider-Man. You know, like you're like, oh, I get to draw a character I love. Why would I think about doing anything else? But there is no better sense of accomplishment when what you want to do gets put out there in the world in whatever form it is.
Yeah, some people seem to come to this realization a lot earlier than others. You know, like it's taken me
a long
time.
They're assholes.
That's right. Because part of me wishes I had done it when I was 20 and I didn't have two kids and a mortgage, because then you can really sink some time into it without having to worry about it paying off.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Making us feel bad. How dare they? But like the car thing is like, it's great. Like I love cars to begin with. So they're very cool. They someone posted, this guy does a daily Alex Toth drawing thing. He puts it up on Instagram. And today it was one of, sort of a page from his Hot Wheels stuff, which are just these beautiful pieces that he did. And I just kind of posed a question, like, if there was an unearthed Alex Toth comic, would you want it to be plane or car based? You know, and I'm like, for me, I want it to be car based. I want to see like some sort of like action adventure happening, you know, maybe some race or something, you know, from a car point of view versus a plane thing, even though his plane comics are great. but I have to settle for you.
I mean, I've never read those Hot Wheels thing, but that was something that I'm not really a big. I don't read a lot of comics. I don't have a background of like. I mean, beyond reading 2000 as a kid, it's not like I have. And I've sort of rectified that and gone back and read all the things that people tell you should read. And right. I've discovered other stuff. Alex Toth, is it? Or Toth?
Toth, yeah. Toth. Yeah.
Alex Toth. Yeah, that was one of the things, that Rob sent me. It was like, this is a bit of a touchstone. Like, check out these, but after that, I mean, the only thing I've seen them is just Google searches. I've never read any of the actual strips. But some of the, I mean, they're just ace. Like, there was one we looked at where there was just like a road going down with a little car at one end, and most of it was black, but it was just perfect. It was like, so simple and so perfect, infuriating. It's not worth looking at them too long because you just get a bit depressed.
No, but it's like this. I think we're, aside from whatever sort of chops he had on a, you know, on a drawing aspect, his composition is so, like, top notch that he is capable of framing everything to give you what you need and nothing more. And that's, you know, because like, I mean, like, how often do you bite off more than you can chew in a panel? And you're like, well, I guess I'm stuck in this thing. I got to draw this, all this stuff.
I'm sure there's a cleverer way to do this, but I'm.
Hey, the only solution is hours now. That's the only solution.
That's right. Jock is another person who has that skill, like that, especially, you know, like these big cityscapes where there's not much in them. And I'm always very jealous of his drawings of buildings and things with just a few dry brush lines and a few highlights. And it's all there and it's got depth. And then I'll spend like 5 hours drawing endless buildings going off into the distance and it doesn't look as big or as interesting.
It is. I mean, it's interesting because, like, I wouldn't sort of lump your work into a sort of a realism category. It's sort of like it's a blend between a cartoon and realism, you know, in that vein, you know. And but I look at people who have things stylized, that they just stylize everything, and I'm like, man, you've got the answer, because you can just make marks and those marks solve the problem.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you can work out a style where, like, you show things in a certain way.
It's like developing your own language.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, you're right. I kind of try and go, Tintin I always quite like for the same reason. You sort of cartoony little guys with just beautiful background drawings. I kind of try and emulate that a little bit.
Yeah. It's super cool. Like, I look, you know, I mean, I had the best time reading Petrolhead. Like, it really felt like fun, cut loose kind of stuff. And, you guys made it very clear, all the stakes and all the characters. There was no sort of like haymaker of this character just showing up in like issue 3, you know, and changing everything in a sense where you're like, wait a minute, what? Like, everything we worked towards is just, you know, now there's a whole new, you know, power dynamic. It wasn't that, like, you've sort of layered everything well enough. You said you didn't read a lot of comic books, like, but you were developing this, I guess, in a sense of a comic book before Rob got involved. Like, were you thinking like this would be one?
Thinking of like a narrative art book. Rob turned up, it would have been a lot of pinups, you know, because I could have written myself an action scene or a chase sequence or something like that. But I think what I love about Petrolhead is that the stakes aren't who wins the race. Mm-hmm. They're always telling you something about the characters, or there's more at stake than just being the world's greatest racing driver.
Right.
And that's what I like about that. But yeah, it would have just been an
art book, like a narrative art book.
Yeah, narrative art book / fucking ego massaging exercise.
What was that? What was that Jamie Hewlett book back in the late '80s? Like, before he did, It's like early on, like with the whole Tank Girl thing, he did a, I think it was like for a magazine that was out of London. And it was like this sort of like car race thing, you know, all these kind of crazy post-apocalyptic kind of world kind of car race madness, but, you know, Hewlettized. So like they're just all these kind of sort of, you know, questionable individuals, you know, behind the wheels of various ilk. And I remember that thing kind of, you know, drips and drabs of that kind of coming across to the US. We never got the whole thing.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen it, or if I have, it's gone out of my brain.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, maybe you want to chase that down, because that was something pretty cool.
I'm going to write it down and Google it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, anything he does is always worth checking out to begin with.
Oh, man, yeah.
Yeah, he was quite like a whack in the head when I first saw his work, you know, in the late 80s. I'm like, how is this? You know, because he wasn't part of that British invasion of artists and writers. He, you know, he and Alan kind of came over fully formed with Tank Girl in a completely different way. Everyone else came over to do US comics, and these guys just, you know, came over like with a shitty, you know, Marshall amp and a guitar, and just, you know, plugged in and just said, here's what you got.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was great. So, all right. Design background. Like for how long were you doing design before you did comics? And like, what was the intro to design for you? How did you get in that round?
Well, I'd always wanted to be an artist. Doing some undefined art stuff. But obviously when you're at school, you tell your careers advisor that, and they don't really know to help you. So they try and, I don't think it's like anything particularly malicious. It's not that I think you can't do it. It's just how does your average person who's used to telling someone to go to business school help someone who wants to draw pictures for a living, especially if they're pictures of, you know, robots or, you know, stupid shit. So I remember at school being told, oh, you should be a graphic designer. I sort of resisted it for years. Oh, no, I don't want to do that. I hate that idea. I don't want to. And then after a couple of years of dead-end jobs, I thought I'd go and do some night classes. And I think I did a night class in digital art or something like that in the late 90s. And then through that, got a job doing design on some hobby magazines. So like I used to design Ready Control Car hobby magazine. And then through that, I got a job at 2000E doing their production work for the comic, which was great because obviously I loved that comic. So it was like, that was a dream come true. And I did that for 13 years maybe. And then just did sort of tried to do my art on the side, but doing art as a part-time thing I was always intended to, you know, I'll get enough jobs in and I'll be able to replace my weight. You cannot do it.
No.
I did it for years, just sort of doing these little side jobs and things. But you think, well, I can work 2 hours or 3 hours a night, every night after work. But that's like, at the end of the week, I've done one day's work.
Yeah.
And you're never going to replace the money you bring in from a full-time job. So I was lucky enough to land a gig doing a comic for a record company, basically. And that's what started me off working for myself and ended up here.
What did that feel like to you when you got that first assignment? Like,
oh, it was amazing. Yeah. I mean, it was a strange one because it wasn't necessarily the comic I'd have chosen to draw myself. But at the same time, you can't, the opportunity to learn on the page as you went and just do the job and get paid reasonably well for it. You know, the page rate was good because it wasn't done for a comics market. It was done with a music budget in mind. I don't get paid that page rate now.
No. Yeah, yeah.
But we did like 400 pages of that. We did like three graphic novels, and we just did them straight as books. And some, I mean, obviously, some of it's a bit, I cringe looking at it now. But it was just the perfect, so lucky.
Yeah. And were you doing that all, I mean, traditional like tools?
Yeah, well, I penciled it. I mean, Petroid's the first thing I've done entirely digitally. So although I ink digitally, I did at least, you know, I did like pages of pencil. So yeah, I've got like a whole draw of all the art from that and various quality.
Sure. Well, like, yeah. I mean, you can be happy with the work that you've done in the past as long as you don't have to look at it.
That's not me knocking it at all, because I'm proud of some of the things I did. And like, by the time I got to the end, I was so much better than when I started. Mm-hmm. As you say, you just don't want to be reminded of it.
I think it's the curse of technique, you know, because technique always improves. And, you know, I think first and foremost, we often judge things on technique if we are practitioners. So we go, ooh, that's some questionable inking there, you know, or like, you know, hey, straight edges are pretty cheap. You could use one on that, you know, drawing, you know, and like, it's that kind of stuff. So, you know, looking back at maybe, you know, like I had this citing the irrepressible Dave Johnson again, but years and years ago, Dave and I were talking about, I mean, and we're like, you know, barely 10 years into our careers at this time. So not that we're any experts of anything at that point, but we were both lamenting this idea that we missed how we felt drawing comics when we first got into drawing comic books. Mm-hmm. And by that, we both felt there was a lot more energy and sort of vigor in our layouts. Like we had this sort of more direct process of, you know, maybe a tiny thumbnail and then kind of drawing that out onto your page with your hands and then kind of just going right at your artwork. And by this point, we had independently developed this much more laborious process of putting a piece of artwork on a piece of paper, you know, with drawings and underdrawings and light boxing and this and that and the other thing. And it looked beautiful in the terms of like technique, but it didn't have that same sort of punch that the earlier work did. And, you know, everybody who draws a comic book, you know, could wish the final page could look as polished as it did, but still feel like that thumbnail, you know?
I was going to say that is the same as just generally your sketch compared to your final thing, you know, you start putting ink on it. Sometimes it just absolutely kills it. You know, there's like, there's a lot to be said for just like a couple of lines. And again, that's one of the lovely things about using physical media is that you can gesture things in a way that you just can't do on a computer, or I can't anyway.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a you thing. I think that's kind of across the board. I think there is a sort of a detachment, even though like you're sitting there with this Apple pencil in my hand and this tablet here, it still doesn't have that same sort of pop as when you have a pencil or a pen on a piece of paper.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons why I kind of did this Petrolhead all digitally, was because a few times I'd do these sort of sketches and stuff, because a lot of it is in the inking, you know. I kind of know my shapes are basic enough that as long as I can work out where something is, I can fill in the details. If I was in a rush, especially, and I was doing stuff in pencil, I'd come to ink it and think, I haven't drawn anything here that I can work with. You know, it looks great, but as soon as I scan it in, I realize I've got no background and none of the perspective's right. And there's like three wiggly lines, which looks like a beautiful something when you look at the paper. But when I come to how do I make this into a final piece of art? So kind of working digitally kind of forced me to do enough work to start with that I wouldn't end up with that problem. But even then you get, you know, just using the pencil tool in Clip Studio, you'll get some things that I can't do with the pen.
Yeah. Yeah. I was sort of evangelizing it, I would say, 2 or 3 years ago, you know, to anyone who's, you know, working digitally. I'm like, just get a copy of Clip Studio and try it, because I really think it makes a drawing process in the digital environment feel more organic.
I'm not a big fan of using like a million and one fancy brushes, but just literally the basic pencil and the basic pen tool are so good in there. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say the other thing I do really enjoy is the whatever the top pen, do you use Procreate?
I have it.
Yeah, just whatever. Because everyone's going to buy it. The basic pencil tool in that is the closest thing to an actual pencil. I found. I love that.
Yeah.
Just the way that it looks and the way you can build it up is very nice. Okay. With the added benefit of that you can then make it white and go over the top, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I found, I don't think, for me, I don't think the fidelity of the Apple Pencil on the iPad is as good as the Cintiq stylus. And
No, I couldn't do any, I couldn't do finished art on it. I know some people do, and I don't know how. Again, like having a design background, I get really finicky about things being the right size or the right width or, you know, that sort of thing. And it's not mathematically, I can't see what number my pen is, you know, what point it is. That bugs me. But for sketching, I really like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I hop, because I'm a bit of, you know, I don't know, a dilettante in this by this point, because I don't do this for anything, you know, that means a whole lot. So I hop around from the programs like, oh, let me try working in this thing. And, you know, and then I'll get frustrated because it doesn't do what I want it to do. And then I'll fall back to, you know, Clip Studio and Photoshop.
Yeah.
For, yeah.
I mean, you say you want to be a writer now, but like, you're doing that. Do you still draw professionally at all or not? I mean, I get
advertising projects. So I do.
Okay.
I do stuff for ad agencies and once again, I have that templatized. So, you know, that to me that's a Photoshop job. I don't even bother anything else. I just work in Photoshop straight through. And then when I do I've done, I don't want to say do because do would mean I'm actually have a project doing it now, but like when I do a variant cover, like I've done variant covers and but that's Clip Studio, color, and Photoshop. So, and like I said, I purchased Procreate or whatever, any program that comes out, you know, for the iPad, because I really want it to be the ultimate tool. I want to be able to like to envision myself, you know, on a ski mountain, taking time out, you know, between lift runs and doing some artwork and then going back, you know, to the mountain.
Yes, and it being just as good as being sitting at your desk at home. Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because listen, they've solved it with the writing side. That laptop works just as well as the desktop computer.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But it doesn't work as well on the iPad. I don't like that keyboard. So.
Oh, interesting. Like, okay.
You know, the iPad is an amazing device, but I'm making the equation. You remember those combination stereo systems, like which had the tape deck, the CD player, the LP player on the top, and it had everything, you know, all built into one thing, radio and everything. And it did all this amazing stuff, but it didn't sound nearly as good as like someone who just had like an amplifier and a record player.
Yeah, separate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's yeah. Right.
So I kind of feel like it's the boombox of artistic creation is the iPad.
I think that's a good analogy actually.
You'll read my obituary tomorrow as Apple has me assassinated, so
he's bad mouthing us on his podcast again.
That's Operation Termination is in play. So when you grew up, like was it just you? Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I've got a household.
Okay, so you got a younger brother.
Yeah, I've got a younger brother.
And what'd your parents do?
My dad's an electrician and my mom was a school secretary.
So totally eager for you to be in the arts.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they were just waiting for me to pick up a pencil. So I don't know. I didn't grow up in particular. That said, both my granddads were sort of engineering draftsmen.
Okay.
On both sides. So my one granddad worked on Concord doing something.
Wow.
Yeah, my grandma told me he had patents out in his name in the Concord plans. I don't know how that works or whether that's true or not, but it's too late to find out now. And then my other granddad did lots of technical drawing, basically. So you probably can't see it, but I've got a lovely old sort of style technical drawing board behind this thing here.
Yeah,
big like A1 thing with a slide rule on it and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that was his. So I mean, it seems kind of fairly fitting if I'm drawing a lot of pipes and wires and stuff. And I did when I was doing my A-levels, I did engineering drawing. So I have kind of that slight inclination. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's no sort of out and out artists in my family.
Okay.
What about you?
So father was an engineer, so that kind of I had that drawing encouragement for that. There were no direct artists, but there were like artistically interested people, you know, in the family, and then lots of encouragement from my mother. And then I think by the time I got to be about 30, she said, like, I kind of regret, you know, encouraging you in the arts. And I'm like, well, thanks again for that, Mom. You know?
Oh, I'd say I got the opposite. It wasn't discouragement, just sort of vague disinterest. Oh, he's up in his room again, drawing pictures of goblins, or, you know.
Right. Oh, so were fantasy things big for you as a kid?
Oh man, I was mental for Warhammer Fantasy Battle when I was in my teens.
Yeah.
I would quite like. I mean, I still quite like painting models. I haven't done it for a little while, but yeah, I am a war gamer.
I was more into the purchasing of them, but never painting them category.
Yes, yeah. This cupboard here has got a lot of grey things in it.
they were all grey. Trust me. I think I primed two figures once, and that was
about it. Oh, okay. Oh no, I was very pleased. I went to a tournament once, and I didn't win, but I got into the shortlist for best painted army, which I was very. That was cool. I text my wife about that to her. She's like, okay, mate.
great. I fell in love with you all over again.
Well done.
Yeah. I had a similar thing in the Scouts as a kid. I didn't win the Pinewood Derby, but I got the best looking car. That was my consolation award.
Yeah. No, that's right. You got the moral victory there.
Oh, yeah, totally. Totally. Came in last, but look at my car. Beautiful. Yeah. That's cool. So you hopped into the graphic design world. It's funny because I was kind of the opposite. You know, I went straight into comic books and then went into graphic design, and you went and the other way around. And I guess you're just reading 2000 AD, and then you got to work there and got to read them for free.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that's right. It's sort of became quite a large part of my personality, if you like, for a little bit, because I was absolutely that age. You know, I read it as a teenager and then stopped for a bit, started again in my sort of early 20s. And then about a year after that, I sort of just randomly advertised in the paper. You know, they were looking for a designer. So go for it, and got it.
It's amazing.
Well, I went for the main job, didn't get that. When they went back through the CVs they'd sent in, when the guy they did hire needed a junior, that's when I got my sort of break in.
Nice. And did you eventually kill him?
The right decision.
Okay. I say, did you eventually kill him and take his position?
I did do that, yes, but only after I'd learned all his knowledge.
Excellent. Excellent. Then you learned rule number one. It says that in the graphic designer's handbook, rule one.
Yeah, steal, drink their brains, gain their knowledge.
They take their position. That's cool. So you, for 13 years, when did you stop working there?
About 8 or 9 years ago, maybe.
Okay. Right on.
And yeah, just been doing freelance stuff since. And I still do work for them and keep in touch and things, because it was quite formative. And
You kind of grew up there.
Yeah, that's right. It's always going to be kind of part of what I do, even if I don't do any stuff for them for a while.
Yeah.
I just feel like I belong to them a little bit. And more specifically, that, you know, the comic belongs to me. So when I look at things that their current designers do and go, oh, it's not right, I'm like, shut up. It's not, you don't own it.
You quickly just check the publisher's name and go, oh, that's not me. Right.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Petra had being sort of kind of birthed from your sort of your wellspring of what makes you happy. That I always talk about the inner 12-year-old, like whatever that inner 12-year-old loved, you still can always love. Like, it's just going to make you smile. And I mean, do you have more 12-year-old things in you that you kind of feel like, all right, this worked, Like, this dance move worked. Maybe I'll go back there and try.
Oh, yeah, that, yeah, absolutely. I think I'd love to do some, some kind of really silly fantasy stuff. You know, like a barbarian, an elf, and a dwarf, and a really traditional Lord of the Ringsy party. That would be fun. Absolutely. I think I listened to your podcast with Duncan Fregredo the other day, and you said the same thing about your, and that is absolutely just channeling that stuff that makes you happy. You know, if you can make sound effects when you're drawing, then you're doing something good.
Oh my God, that's so, I love that. I'm stealing that from you, by the way. Because wasn't that like the 90% of the reason to sit there in your, you know, in your young classroom and making those drawings, and then just, you know, if you're making a tank, you're like blowing things up, and
yeah,
it was great.
Yeah, cars are skidding and people are screaming, and
I'm thinking, like, I should ask my old roommate, like, did I make sounds drawing like my pages? I wonder.
I bet you did.
I don't know. We were both pretty uptight, so we probably were just kind of quiet and listening to the music and trying not to upset one another. I'll have to, but I'm gonna ask him. So that'll be a thing. Okay, so fantasy. That could be a thing.
Yeah, I'd quite like to do that. I mean, I do still have a bit of a soft spot for Games Workshop stuff, and I'd love to do some of that for exactly the same reason. I just liked it as a kid.
Yeah,
you know.
Did you read those comics?
The only one I've got is like one that Kev Walker did called Demonifuge, which is just because I love Kev Walker's art. I think he's amazing, and he did this sort of fully painted Sisters of Battle story, which is just utterly beautiful.
Oh wow.
But apart from that, no, I looked at them, but I was never that bothered by the drawings, really.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you look at the art in the rule books, I mean, that's the stuff that used to blow my face off.
So I grew up playing D&D, and that was like the thing. Like I think every comic book player or comic book artist who played like D&D or maybe any other kind of, you know, game, is that it was the art in the rule book that sold us.
Yeah, this is a formative memory for me, and I've been trying to track it down for years. There's a book that Games Workshop put out, had no rules in it. It was just pure fluff. And it was called Wow the Orcs. And all it was a source book of just like little stories, background stuff, and just incredible illustration by this guy called Paul Bonner. I don't know whether you know his work.
No.
But like they're like, he does these watercolors. Incredible.
I'm writing it down. Yeah.
But like, just these beautiful watercolor paintings that are of just epic landscapes and stuff. But they've always got this little silly twist in them. So his drawings for orcs are just the best because they're always hilarious and just full of detail and, you know, just loads of charm and character.
I mean, that stuff always sold me. I mean, I think I would say probably 20 to 40% of my reason I played D&D was so I could sit there and draw while we were playing. Like okay, I can sit here and I can kind of get lost in my own imagination while we're all living within each other's imagination, just to have some extra fun.
Yeah, I only played D&D for the first time in lockdown. Actually, that was with a couple of mates, and it was really good fun. The first thing I did was like came up with this character, and after a couple of sort of sessions, I was like, I've got to draw this guy. This is fun.
It's a bit of a compulsive thing. I learned a lot playing D&D, and this is something that, you know, you were talking about the lack of, and I'm just going to use the word confidence, of writing your own story, even though you have the ideas and converting that into an actual like logical story. I found D&D was where I learned how to sort of be a part of that. And because it's like the DM sort of throws the job onto you, the player, to write the story when it's like your turn. You know, not just like, you know, I roll my 20-sided dice to kill something, but it's like you're in a role-playing situation. So you have to kind of like figure those things out. And I didn't know that at the time. This is stuff that I wasn't cognizant of. And then when I sit down to write prose, I'm like, oh, that's what this is. This is just me in that moment. And the DM's like, so what do you do? You're like, you know, and then you're on the hook and you got to come up with something.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Cross training.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I wouldn't need anyone if I could write things and then I'd never leave the house.
I mean, listen, we love Rob and Rob's amazing and, you know, we don't want to but, you know, I don't know, you know, maybe just jot a few things down. Can't hurt.
Okay. Give it a go. Yeah, maybe I will.
It's a terrifying prospect. And I think, and I say it all the time, but I think the thing that scared me the most was writing dialogue. That was the thing that I was always most afraid of. Like, I didn't really go like, I don't think I could come up with an idea. It was more of like, this is going to sound stupid.
Mm.
I guess it's maybe that public speaking thing, like where writing dialogue is sort of equivalent of public speaking because you're saying something and it's there on the page, you know, for posterity.
Yeah.
I'd worry about
cutting corners, knowing that you're going to draw something you've written as well. Worry about either like playing to the strengths to the detriment of everything else. You know, like, I'm not very good at that, so I won't put that in, even though that's what it requires.
It's okay. I'll trim it. Well, I mean, the idea of playing to your strengths is a big one. You know, people I know who do write and draw their own stuff, they talk about that internal battle of having to really sort of bifurcate their mind and like be the writer when they write and then be the artist when they, you know, and be angry at one another, you know, for yes, whatever they did.
Yeah. Like a crime scene for the horses.
Right. Exactly. But I mean, you bite off a lot more than you could chew, you know, with the cars. I mean, like cars are the, you know, almost as bad as motorcycles. You must love drawing them.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Absolutely. My favorite thing, just sort of taking a car or seeing, you know, finding a car that exists and finding ways to sort of pull it apart and chop bits off and do all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. What was it like? What was the origin of the cars thing for you? Like for me, Hot Wheels were like a huge thing when I was a kid.
Yeah, Matchbox cars in England. We didn't really have so much Hot Wheels, but I had plenty of toy cars. And then, when I got my PlayStation, Gran Turismo sort of supercharged it. As soon as I could learn to drive, and Gran Turismo came out, just all of a sudden you're sort of given the name of every single car that you see anywhere, and it's hard not to get obsessed. And lots of my friends do motor racing and track days and all that kind of thing. So it's very much, you know, if I go to the pub on a Thursday night, it'll be 2 hours of chatting about some car or other that no one can afford.
Right. Yeah. So book five, I guess, just hit the stands.
Yeah, today.
Yeah, right. So as we're recording, book five is out and I guess a collected edition may be in the works.
Yeah, I was literally that's been my job today. I've been designing the trade paperback.
Nice.
So I've kind of finished that about 20 minutes before we logged on.
Nice.
And that's out in June. Again, doing the design and stuff myself, because I don't know, I like doing that. However, I have a little bit of a problem on this editing myself and trying to make it perfect. It's a job that should take a day, and it's taken me about four. Just purely because I'm designing all these little widgets and agonizing over tiny little things. I mean, there's not even that many design pages in this. It's going to be the first book's going to be fairly bare bones because Image sort of suggested we go for quite a low price point because we're fairly, you know, I'm a complete unknown in America, really. And the story is new. So I said, well, let's just make it as cheap as we possibly can. So although me and Rob would like a big oversized hardback with 20 pages of sketches in the back and a script and stuff, we can't, if we do that, we're not going to make any money at all. So we've had to sort of strip it back a little bit. But it is, you know, it is going to be like $10 for the entire thing.
Which is a super great deal. I mean, I'm a big fan of trying to keep the prices down because I think more people will kind of dive in if they can get something you know, at a lower price point. I mean, forget Rob's work in the process. When you first started posting stuff, or when I first saw your work being posted, and I don't know how it crossed my path, but like, you know, it was so refreshing to see something like your work on the pages of a comic. I hope the sales are reflecting, you know, the unique qualities of the book.
Well, if I'm being honest, like that, we are somewhat disappointed in that, to be honest. That's like, it's not like it's not made any money at all, but I had a kind of figure in my head of how much I wanted it to sell. Mm-hmm. And it's about that. But like, I would have been over the, I was thinking, you know, right, I'm going to be absolutely despairing if it comes back as this, and I'm going to be over the moon if it's this, and it was somewhere in the middle.
Right.
But it does, it's kind of, because of the way that the stuff seems to have sold, and people have told us this, you know, you'll sell a lot of the first issue and then it'll tail off massively, and then you'll make a little bit more money on the book. Mm-hmm. So we'll see if that's true, really. Certainly it has been so far. You know, we made some money on the first one, but not much off the rest.
Right.
It's kind of getting through those to get the book out.
Did you do Thought Bubble this year?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So are you doing any other shows?
I'm at the Science Fiction Weekender in Great Yarmouth this weekend, which is a funny little con, because it's like, it's on a caravan park, and like the same people go every year. So it's almost like a club rather than a convention. But it is a good laugh, and there's some good guys going. So that's not really a money-making exercise. That's just a good laugh.
Right.
But yeah, Rob was talking about doing Thought Bubble again, and I think I'm doing Enniskillen in Ireland. But yeah, that's it. I'd like to come to America again. I haven't been to a US con since I worked at 2008.
Like, we did
New York one year and San Diego. And they were fun. But obviously, you know, doing it on your own steam is an entirely different thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say so. I guess series two, you guys are you talking about it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm just, what I'm doing at the minute is, just getting up enough of a cushion of money together over the next 6 months to sit and be unpaid for a bit, basically. That's how I'm going to approach it. Because we've got a little bit of a royalties check, but it's not enough to live on. And even so, we kind of, you still have to front load quite a lot of work before you get those checks in. So I'm going to spend the next 6 months doing anything I can to get as much money as I can, and start working on the second series in August or September.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like every time I say this kind of stuff, I'm like, I sound like some sort of like shill or something, but like, it's like the work is so like, so cool. Like I can't like, it's hard to express. I think I've expressed it in the unique qualities that you're putting down on the page of the technique. But if you're listening and you don't know this book, you know, Petrolhead, it's in the shops. I think it's great. Like, I mean, I'm a car guy, so maybe that's, it speaks to me, but it's, I don't know, like the longer I've been a fan of comic books, the more I'm interested in things that are not just what I expect from comic books.
Thank you very much. Yeah. It's very cool.
And I think this sits in that space where you're getting like some top shelf, you know, product, you know, and story, but you're not getting the thing that you may think you know.
Right.
So,
I really believe in it. That's the main reason I want to do more, is because I think it is something that's worthwhile carrying on with. And I get such joy from it that,
It's a great story. And I'm also really sort of like excited that how it got off the ground versus being this, you know, it's just a different direction. You know, it came from a point of sort of shared interest and love to two creative people kind of developing something together.
Yeah, no, it's nice, and it's great when you can kind of make each other laugh when you're working on stuff like this. This is one of those things that I enjoy about it, is that you know, I'll draw something that will crack Rob up, but it's based on a joke that or I'll read the script and I'll be laughing at some sort of random bit of dialogue. I think there's a line in issue three, which is just, it's not even a joke, but it's just like, I think Hybrid, or one of the racing cast drivers, says, look, she haunts my robo dreams. Like, for some reason, just properly crack me up. And, you know, and I'll send pictures to Rob and he'll be like, I've just been giggling about this for 5 minutes. And I love that.
Yeah.
Kind of bouncing backwards and forwards and stuff.
Yeah. And the designs are great, man. The car designs, the robot designs. They're very cool. Like the sort of the overlord robots, love the way they look. And I want to know what happens, because like clearly one came out on top. Like I want to know how that whole, you know, that story, how that comes together and where, you know, where they end up. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I mean, I have a vague idea of where it's going, but I'm as excited to read the next part as anyone else when Rob sends it through.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are enough sort of, you know, amuse bouches sitting there like on little silver trays, just waiting to be, you know, et.
Yes. That's right. Especially the first issue is there's just so many little throwaway things that you could explore.
Yeah.
Obviously it's quite a fast moving thing, so you tend to concentrate on what's immediately in front of you, but we could easily go and do things in other cities, explain it. Cause we'd have, there's no indication of how people live in this world.
No, it feels very tight focus in that sense. Like you just don't know what's happening outside of the space where you are, which is the structure of design of the whole thing. But it, that's kind of cool. So, I mean, it kind of leaves a lot for Rob to play with. You know, he's like, he's taking your matchboxes and he's like, okay, I'm going to set up a whole, you know, course here. And then you have to like look at this course and go, oh, okay. Now I got to,
yeah,
I got to draw all this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very cool. So I encourage anybody to get their hands on this because it is great, or wait for June and get the, you know, get the trade when it comes out.
Do both.
But the everyone recommends buying comics twice. Are you doing anything else outside of this? That, you know, the old covers or whatever.
I've got a couple of things at the minute. So I have a story that I basically took a hiatus on from 2008. So that one of those files I sent yesterday was for a story called Intestinals.
Yeah, very cool stuff.
Yeah, it's like sort of Petrolhead Junior in a lot of ways. I got two parts into that and then had to sort of send a very apologetic email just saying, look, I've had this opportunity, I can't miss, so I'm gonna, sorry, but I'm gonna have to do it for a bit. And obviously, it helps having a bit more of a personal relationship with the editor because obviously, he's to sit next to him for a long time.
Right.
Whereas I think your average freelancer might be a bit more wary about asking that question. But he was very good about it, so I've got to finish that in the next month, I've got like a couple of variant covers to do for a couple of things. And me and Rob have another pitch, which I've not started looking at yet.
Okay.
And yeah. And then after that, I'm kind of doing other jobs really. Like I'm looking at just some random computer game advertising work.
Mm-hmm.
It pays better than comics. So I'll do it for as short a time as I can to get some money in and then leave it at that.
Yeah. Yeah. I always have to remind myself when I'm doing those types of jobs, like do a very good job. But don't like break your neck on these things because that's not what they're expecting sometimes. They're just expecting really, like, if you could just pull off a competent solution.
Yeah, it's not actually helpful being perfectionist about something sometimes because you just end up asking questions that no one has answers to. So you might as well just do it.
Yeah, or you ask those questions, they go, well, let us get back to you, and then like things change.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I think I put myself in a handholding role much more so than I need to with a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm the same. I'll kind of worry about things and, end up just making things more complicated than they need to be just because I want to know absolutely everything instead of just making the decision and doing it.
Right. All right. So I have one final big question. Did you see Dune?
right? And the saga of June continues. I missed it the other day. We went to book it for Tuesday this week, but then Charlotte realised that her dad didn't want the kids again because although his home wasn't feeling very well, so she couldn't come. And I was just about to book tickets. I was like, okay, we won't bother. She was like, oh, you can go on your own. So I booked tickets today for Sunday and then remembered I'm at this convention at the weekend, so I had to cancel them immediately. So no, and I've got no plans. And if I'm not careful, it's not going to be at the cinema.
I know. We just got back from the other side of the country yesterday. And I said to my wife, I'm like, Mom, like, let's not forget Dune. And she's just like, I can't think about that for a couple of days. I'm like, a couple of days. Like, I'm getting all anxious that it's going to go out of like the nice cinema, you know, and into the really small.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be a knob about it, but I really want to see it in IMAX. Like, I want to see it in the biggest screen I possibly can.
I want the best sound. Yeah. I want the best. Yeah. I'm a bit anxious that we're going to miss it. Like for the big show. And I'm going to be really sad because I've just so enjoyed the first film and I can't wait to see how this thing comes together.
Oh man. Yeah, no, I can't wait. I'm sort of, do you like the David Lynch version? Cause I've always had a very soft spot.
Oh yeah. 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 I mean, I saw it in the theater when it came out. I really enjoyed it.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's one of those things. Cause I was introduced to the book by that film.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's always informed the way I kind of thought about it. I must have caught it late one night on Channel 4 or something here.
It also came out with the comic book. So there was this amazing.
Yeah, I've never seen that. Yeah, the Bill Sienkiewicz one. Yeah, I've never read it. I'd love to have it.
I mean, the artwork is amazing. I'll just, the artwork is, because he's in like full strength. Like he's as good as he ever, could be doing this thing. And it's just, it's way out there. Just very cool.
Mm.
So hunt that down. What was the other thing I told you to hunt down? The
Jamie Hewlett car's coming.
The Jamie Hewlett thing. Yeah. So don't worry. I wrote my things down that you mentioned. And,
yeah, I've got homework. I'll go and do it.
I know. I've got homework as well. All right, Pi. Thank you, man. It's
cheers, real pleasure. It's lovely to meet you.
Yeah. And get that file done. Don't be such a perfectionist and get it to the printer. No one's going to know but you. Trust me.
No. Oh, mate, I know. I spend a lot of my life just doing things that no one's going to notice. The world wouldn't be correct.
That's true. Your world would not be right and you couldn't sleep. I get it. Yeah, it was a pleasure. And I can't wait to see what you guys come up with in the next round.
I know it will come out. We're absolutely doing it. I've just got to find a way to make it work because it's not quite paying for itself at the minute.
That's the rub of comics, isn't it?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, that's it. I mean, I'd suck the whole thing off, but it's such fun. I could be a lot richer doing something else, but I don't want to do something else.
This is the curse of wanting to do something.
Yes.
All right, my friend. Many thanks.
Yeah. Cheers, dude. See you later. Bye.